Good afternoon. My name is Doug Cox. On behalf of the D.C. Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society, welcome to our July luncheon. We're honored and delighted to have as our guest today Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General of the United States and the Society's good friend and advisor. Ted will be sharing with us his annual roundup of the recent Supreme Court term. It's always notable, it's always really, frankly, amazing that we can pull such a crowd on a Friday afternoon in summer, and our numbers today reflect our enduring respect and affection for Ted. Well, another Supreme Court term, another opportunity for Justice Kennedy to fulfill his dramatic destiny. He continues, of course, to be the court's swing voter. David Broder wrote last weekend that Justice Kennedy is, quote, arguably the single most influential arbiter of domestic policy in the land. Broder went on to write that Justice Kennedy's exercise of that policy power fulfilled President Reagan's wildest dreams for the Supreme Court, and in particular, the president's expectation that Justice Kennedy would be a, quote, true conservative. Who would have suspected that the famously understated David Broder has such a talent for cruel and mocking humor? But it's not merely his role in the 5-4 decisions that makes Justice Kennedy the swing vote. This year, the justice got the opportunity to show off his truly great expertise in swinging from one position to its opposite. Having 2 years ago joined Justice Breyer's concurrence in Hamdan, which stated that Congress and the President could create a system to try terrorists by military commission, in Boumediene, Justice Kennedy turned around and struck down the very system that Congress and the President designed to do just that. In so doing, Justice Kennedy has executed the rarely seen and technically difficult "I was for it before I was against it" backflip swing. If you go to the website, Senator John Kerry immediately issued a press release praising the decision. He also scored Justice Kennedy 9.5 on technique. It cannot be said, however, that Justice Kennedy doesn't respond to criticism. Obviously stung by Justice Scalia's assertion in his dissent in Boumediene that more Americans would die as a result of the court's decision, Justice Kennedy seized the very next opportunity to save the life of an American. That American just happened to be on death row in Louisiana. Our guest today is an expert in the difficult job of keeping up with the evolving standards of decency with specific marks on the way to full progress and mature judgment that can be found in Justice Kennedy's jurisprudence. Indeed, Ted is an expert in the thinking of all of the justices and demonstrates that expertise in case after case. Although Ted likes to give us some numbers at these lunches, here are a few he may not get around to. Ted concluded his tenure as Solicitor General with an astonishing win rate of 82%. Since his return to private practice, he put together a different team to back him up, and his win rate is now 87%. Indeed, in the term just concluded, Ted argued 3 cases and won them all. He not only won all 3 cases, he won 26 out of 27 possible votes from the justices. That's roughly 96% of the votes. Who is the outlier, the one justice to stubbornly dissent? It's Justice Ginsburg. Over the last several years, purely as a matter of voting patterns, she has been the justice least likely to agree with Ted's position in a given case. On the very first day of the next Supreme Court term, and the very first argument, Ted will stand up and give his 50th argument before the court. That's really a remarkable accomplishment. Ted also, of course, continues to attract media attention. He was recently described in commentary as a conservative legal icon. Just in the last few months, the media also have called Ted a big gun, the Washington super lawyer, the gold standard for conservatives, and the best legal talent money can buy. And Gibson Dunn is proudest, I think, of that last accolade. Ted received his law degree in 1965 from the University of California at Berkeley and joined the Gibson Dunn Law Firm in its Los Angeles office. In 1981, he was appointed by President Reagan to serve as Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Upon returning to the private sector, he joined Gibson Dunn's Washington office, where he led the firm's appellate practice. In 2000, of course, he argued and won both of the election cases in the Supreme Court. Thereafter, he was confirmed as Solicitor General, and he served in that position from 2001 to 2004. At the time of Ted's resignation, Nina Totenberg of NPR stated, quote, "By everyone's reckoning, he's done an outstanding job." Ted once again returned to Gibson Dunn, where he continues his appellate and constitutional law practice and also leads the firm's crisis management practice. He is a fellow of both the American College of Trial Lawyers and the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers. Last year, as the presidential campaign ramped up, he led Mayor Giuliani's Judicial Advisory Committee. Ted was widely viewed as bringing conservative credibility to a campaign that badly needed it. When that job somehow came to an abrupt end, Ted became co-chairman of Senator McCain's Judicial Advisory Committee. And Ted is described as bringing conservative credibility to Senator McCain's campaign. Ted has also been mentioned by serious commentators as a possible attorney general, a possible senator from Virginia, and a possible Supreme Court justice. For those of you keeping count, that's one high-level job in each of the three branches. Given all of this, it is not surprising that in December 2007, Washingtonian Magazine picked Ted as Washington's top lawyer. The Washington Post even recently described Ted as, quote, "one of the premier lawyers of the day and a man of intellectual heft and gravitas. His stature and accomplishments are so overwhelming that even the Post gets it, Ted."
You went on too long, Doug. Well, thank you, Federalist, for your warm welcome. It's a pleasure to be here again. And shame on you, Doug, for that extravagant introduction. Not that I object to excessive flattery. Indeed, you are to be commended for your keen instincts. This is my 15th summary of a just-ended Supreme Court term for the Federalist Society. That milestone momentarily tempted me to consider giving a speech highlighting the court's most memorable decisions during these last 15 years. Unfortunately, I think that would bring my audience to tears. And a 1 year's dose of these decisions is about all that anybody can take at any one time. Maybe we'll do that when they legalize opium. Most of you are familiar with our quirky custom of commencing each Supreme Court roundup with a brief tribute to a recent spectacle of such appalling public conduct that it raises serious questions about what God was thinking when he put us on this planet. As some of you will recall, previous winners have included the California State Bar President, who actually proposed in the legislature to make a hate crime out of telling lawyer jokes. Another one was Hillary Milhouse Clinton for her invention of the underwear tax deduction and her amazing skill at cattle futures. Time Magazine reporter was a third, Nina Burley, for offering oral sex in gratitude to Bill Clinton for keeping abortion legal. The term she used was a little bit more less elegant than oral sex. Sharon Stone for feeding her husband's feet to a poisonous 5-foot lizard. And the paragon of political correctness, Washington Post publisher, who made it a workplace crime to brush up against another person in an elevator at the Washington Post. These are all true stories, and some of you remember those awards and those events. Someday we should establish a Hall of Fame for these everyday heroes who sacrifice their credibility and dignity in order to enrich the lives of those of us living more, quote, quotidian existences. As usual, this year's prize could go to any number of worthy recipients. An obvious nominee suggested to me by many people is former Governor Eliot Spitzer. However, the man who will forever be remembered in Wikipedia as client number 9 has already become yesterday's news. As a consolation, however, he will receive a Coles to Newcastle award for importing New York hookers into the District of Columbia. Somehow the question, what was he thinking, doesn't do justice to that decision. We've decided instead to pay homage to someone who we could probably have selected any time at any one of the past 15 years. I know at this point you're thinking, who is it? Jesse Jackson, who recently offered to geld Barack Obama. Or the Democratic Party itself, whose greening director, I read in today's Washington Post, has mandated for the Denver Convention specific proportions of politically correct colors for the food served at the convention in Denver. But those aren't the winners. Who else should we choose but Madonna? She accomplished a celebrity hat trick this week, dumping her husband while simultaneously breaking up the marriage of Alex and Cynthia Rodriguez, beginning a performance tour which even she calls sweet and sticky, and starring in a book authored by her own brother, which is said to chronicle her sexual contests, drug-taking, and lesbian flings. This book is described by the New York Post as a warts-and-all biography. I'm going to skip the chapter about the warts. The Post also reports that if A-Rod stays with Madonna, he will have to convert to Kabbalah, an ancient Jewish mystical philosophy practiced by celebrities such as Madonna, which requires a red string bracelet and ridding oneself of one's ego. As I understand it, if A-Rod gives enough money to the Kabbalah Center, and of course wears the red string bracelet, his ego will shrink to the size of Madonna's. A-Rod hasn't asked me for my advice, but if he did, I'd suggest that he stick with buxom strippers and introduce Madonna to someone better suited to her religious convictions and temperament. Maybe Tom Cruise. All right, enough. We've had too much fun. This will be the bad part. So we'll turn to the serious but ever-shrinking task of evaluating the work of the Supreme Court the previous 9 months. The court issued opinions in only 67 cases this term, the fewest since 1953-54, the first year of the Warren Court. 15 years ago, when I first did this speech, there were 110 opinions. There were 150 or so 25 years ago, and over 250 in the early 1930s. The court is now down to a 7.4 opinion per justice rate per term, 7.4 opinions for the court per justice. If the trend continues, we'll have to stop this lunch business and make this an appetizer speech. A third of the court's opinions were unanimous. Only 11 were 5-4, reflecting a bit more agreement than the previous term, when the court, as you recall, was divided 5-4 last term in 24 cases, with Justice Kennedy providing that the same Justice Kennedy mentioned by Doug Cox, providing the deciding vote in each of those 24 5-4 decisions. This time, Justice Kennedy was the swing vote in 8 of the 11 5-4 decisions, but those were the court's headline cases, and commentators, for that reason, are still calling it the Kennedy Court. For good reason. If the case involved campaign finance, securities, standing, Indian tribes, illegal immigrants, terrorists, guns, or the hottest cases of the term, you had to get as an advocate, you had to get Justice Kennedy, or you lost. The court reversed or remanded in two-thirds of its cases, which is more or less typical. Appellants usually lose in appellate courts, but the Supreme Court selects its own docket, frequently taking a case where four of the justices don't like the decision, and hence the high reversal rate. It is very hard to get the court to take a case, less than 1 in 100 now, but if it does, you can place your bets on the petitioner. You will be thrilled to learn, and Judge O'Scanlan from that court is here today, that the Ninth Circuit did somewhat better this year, primarily, it must be said, because the court didn't take as many of the Ninth Circuit cases. Judge O'Scanlan's always on the right side of those cases, I might say, but the Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit and only 8 1/2 of the Ninth Circuit's trips to the Supreme Court this term. This is called the blind pig phenomena. Now, some of you don't know the slogan, but the 2007 term will probably be remembered primarily for a few headline decisions, which I will discuss in more detail in a moment, including the Second Amendment ruling allowing District of Columbia citizens gun possession rights comparable to those already possessed by the district's criminals. Let me mention a couple of other noteworthy events at the beginning. First, this was a relatively disappointing year in the court for the United States. The government usually wins most of its cases in which it participates, typically prevailing in well over two-thirds of its cases. This term, if my calculations are correct, the government did only slightly better than 50%, winding up on the losing side in more than 20 cases. These included defeats in crime and sentencing, money laundering, campaign finance, the False Claims Act, presidential power, and in part, at least, that Second Amendment case. The government, along with everyone else, I might add, also failed to advise the court of a recently enacted federal death penalty statute for child rapists, an omission repeated in the court's opinion, which is already generating probably futile calls for re-argument in that case. I hasten to say this is not a reflection on the quality of the advocacy of the Solicitor General's office, which remains the gold standard, unquestionably. The government simply can't select all of the cases which it is required to defend, and some of them are just plain losers. It had more than its share this term. A corollary to the government's diminished success this term was good news for those accused of crime, slated for deportation, or otherwise singled out for government disfavor. The previous term was hailed by many as a big year for business. This year, business did well, winning preemption, arbitration, securities, punitive damages, and False Claims Act cases. But criminals and terrorists did even better. Winning cases involving habeas, sentencing, money laundering, the Fourth and Sixth Amendment, and for child rapists at least, immunity from capital punishment. Death row litigants can now also add Justice Stevens to the categorically opposed to capital punishment column. He decided, based on his language, his own experience, that capital punishment is invariably a violation of Eighth Amendment. It's very hard to refute that logic. How liberating. Two notable resignations occurred this term. Paul Clement, after 7 years as Principal Deputy Solicitor General and Solicitor General, Paul had a remarkable run, earning the unanimous respect of the justices, government officials, opposing counsel, and the lawyers in his office. He was a superb oral advocate, speaking without notes, and handling the government's most difficult cases with eloquence and grace. He now has, at the tender age of 42 years, argued 49 cases before the Supreme Court. If the next president is looking for someone with the credentials, talent, experience, and wisdom to warrant appointment to the court, and who the new Senate will have a very hard time rejecting, Paul Clement will have to be among the handful on anybody's short list. The other resignation is the departure of Linda Greenhouse. Don't applaud yet. The Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times Supreme Court reporter. Through her many years covering the court and her book Becoming Justice Blackmun, she has been one of the nation's leading journalistic authorities on the workings of the court and the thinking of the justices. Many commentators even give her credit or blame for influencing the evolution of Republican appointees on the court from cruelty and stupidity toward decency, wisdom, and the blessed kingdom of moderation. Our dear friend Larry Silverman, in a Federal Society speech several years ago, called this the greenhouse effect. He was not talking about global warming. Several times during this term, the court rejected facial constitutional challenges to statutes that were alleged to have unconstitutional applications. The court left these laws or practices standing if they were reasonably amenable to constitutional applications. For example, the court declined to hold that lethal injections necessarily violated the Eighth Amendment, upheld a facial challenge for the first time in years in a child pornography case, and sustained Indiana's requirement of a government-issued photo ID as a condition for voting. These were 7-2 and 6-3 decisions and arose in contexts that approached differently might have resulted in 5-4 splits. Justice Stevens was in the majority in each case, producing the court's opinion in the voter ID case and separate concurring opinions in the other two, to emphasize in each instance that there was much that he disapproved of the law or practice under consideration, and to stress that a different context might produce a different result. Justice Stevens is nothing if not crafty, and he may have joined the majority in those cases precisely to narrow substantially the impact of a decision with which he probably did not agree, and to ease the way for a contrary outcome if he can pick up another vote the next time around. Precedent, or stare decisis, continues to be an important subtext in many of the court's decisions, with each faction of a closely divided court seeking to hold on to yesterday's victory and to avoid today's defeats. For an interesting discussion, for those geeks in the audience that are really interested in this sort of thing, read the otherwise forgettable case of John R. Sand and Gravel, containing dueling Brandeis and Holmes stare decisis quotes from Justice Stevens, Ginsburg, and Breyer. I have to mention a case like that every speech to make sure you think, or make, get you to believe that I've actually read all these cases. The Supreme Court had to decline cert and affirm the decision below in one case, Kulumani versus Barclays Bank, because it could not muster a quorum. The case involved the Alien Tort Claims Act, a provision that gives district courts jurisdiction in suits by aliens for torts committed in violation of the law of nations, whatever the law of nations means. It is increasingly being used by foreign nationals who claim to have been injured by some objectionable practice in a foreign country. In this case, scores of banks and manufacturers were being sued for injuries suffered by apartheid victims in South Africa. The reach of this law cries out for Supreme Court clarification, but four justices had to recuse themselves, presumably under Title 28 U.S.C. 455, which mandates disqualification where a jurist has a financial interest, however insignificant, in one of the parties. Since a quorum in the Supreme Court is 6, a 3-judge Second Circuit decision had to be affirmed, and a massive, massive litigation must continue. Two other cases accepted for review and argued this term had to be affirmed by an equally divided court because of recusals, and one issue was left undecided in the Exxon punitive damages case because of another recusal. These examples suggest that there ought to be some way temporarily to replace a recused justice on the Supreme Court, or that the standards for recusal in cases involving ownership of securities should be reconsidered by Congress. It seems obvious that if a justice or family member owns a tiny fractional interest in a widely held public company, a recusal is silly, and the parties and the country is denied potential decision by the nation's highest court. That is something that should be changed. The liberal mainstream media continues to portray the court as consisting of 4 Neanderthals, 4 saints, and 1 justice who vacillates between Mother Teresa and Charles Manson. The New York Times is probably the worst offender, particularly its editorial pages, but the other major media outlets are not far behind. The bias is often open and sometimes quite subtle. For example, after the Second Amendment decision, Linda Greenhouse speculated in the pages of the New York Times that it will probably take many more cases to flesh out how far the court intends to go to replace legislative choices for gun regulations. Needless to say, this sudden solicitude for legislative choices was not mentioned when the court struck down Louisiana's death penalty for pedophiles who raped 8-year-old girls. The same day, the Washington Post reported that a win by McCain could push the court to the right, while a win by Obama will preserve the uneasy but roughly balanced status quo. Anybody see a point of view seeping in? Now we'll turn, with your patience and indulgence, to a few specific cases. Contrary to the critics who were appalled by the Supreme Court dared to review indefensible decisions by the Florida Supreme Court in 2000 that could have changed the outcome of a national presidential election, the court has always been sensitive to how we conduct elections in this country. This term, it overturned Second and Ninth Circuit decisions rejecting state primary election systems in New York and Washington. The Supreme Court essentially told the Second Circuit that if political parties wanted to skew their procedures to favor party loyalists over party insurgents in judicial nomination conventions, they had a First Amendment associational right to do so. And in the Washington case, the court sustained the primary system, which allows the two most popular candidates in the primary, irrespective of their political party, to move on to the general election. The court is saying that political parties have reasonable freedom to set the rules for selecting their own standards bearers, as they should. In other words, Hillary Clinton would probably have been stuck with her party's decision regarding the Michigan and Florida primary balloting. Maybe that's why she finally gave up. The court also upheld Indiana's voter identification law. The Justice Stevens plurality opinion found that requiring a government-issued photo ID as a condition for voting was a special burden. Those IDs are heavy, but not bad enough to block the enforcement of the statute. Three other justices found the burden minimal and fully justified. Absent evidence of substantial disenfranchisement in actual practice, therefore, it is now clearly permissible for states to impose the same voter identification requirements that we encounter every day at airports, government buildings, libraries, and convenience stores where cigarettes are sold. It seems remarkable to me that three justices actually believe that it is unconstitutional on its face to have to credibly identify yourself in order to cast a ballot in this country. The fourth election decision struck down a provision of McCain-Feingold called the Millionaire's Amendment, as if it meant anything to be a millionaire anymore. That amendment lifted contribution limits for those unfortunate candidates facing opponents willing to spend lots of their own money to get elected. In a well-written but hotly contested 5-4 decision, Justice Alito explained that the court had never upheld a law imposing different contribution limits on competing candidates based on their wealth or anything else for that matter. The dissenters, particularly Justice Stevens, were forced by this case to come out from under the canard that limits on campaign contributions and solicitations are justified by a compelling governmental interest in controlling corruption and the, quote, appearance of corruption. In fact, the McCain-Feingold Act was enacted without any substantial evidence of actual federal election corruption, which, if it did occur, is already covered by laws prohibiting bribery, extortion, conflicts of interest, real corruption. So the specter of appearance of corruption is trotted out along with polls that show that the public believes that contributions buy elections. In fact, the appearance of corruption is an imaginary monster deployed to justify all manner of restrictions on electioneering activities that would never be accepted to control other, more sacrosanct First Amendment activities such as naked dancing and advocating the overthrow of the United States government. Campaign contributions and the mention of God seem to be the only activities that can be regulated because of the appearance of some generally unsubstantiated, substantiated, and largely imagined evil. The real reason behind campaign contribution and expenditure limits, particularly as revealed by the Stevens opinion, is the desire to level the election playing field to reduce the advantage of wealth in election contests. But the First Amendment ought to prohibit government from handicapping candidates to eliminate perceived advantages. Let the voters decide. The level playing field rationale would presumably allow, in addition to congressional limits on the use of wealth, to place egalitarian limits on the advantages held by candidates with good looks, oratorical skills, famous names like, say, Kennedy, or the kind of celebrity status enjoyed by an Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ronald Reagan, or Jesse Ventura. The greatest advantage of all, of course, is incumbency. But members of Congress don't think incumbency is a bad thing. So campaign finance reform generally winds up helping incumbents and disadvantaging challengers. At least five justices of the Supreme Court seem to have figured this one out. Hence, the Millionaire Amendment went down in flames. Speaking of cruel and unusual punishment, simply reading the court's Eighth Amendment decision striking Louisiana's child rapist death penalty imposes, as the court would put it, an objectively intolerable risk of serious pain. This was a Justice Kennedy opinion, as you heard from Doug, who tries to get some of the my stuff. I don't know, he sneaks in at night and looks at my stuff. So I'm going to do it anyway. This was, as you now know, a Justice Kennedy opinion, which you probably knew anyway, which concluded that, quote, evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society and that embrace and express respect for dignity of the person preclude a death sentence for a violent, cruel rape of an 8-year-old girl by a recidivist stepfather. The injuries inflicted by this crime were the most severe the pediatric forensic medicine expert had ever seen in his career. And the defendant, whose name coincidentally was Kennedy, had previously raped another 8-year-old girl. The court rejected the death penalty for all non-murder crimes against individuals. The opinion starts with the banal proposition that when the law punishes by death, quote, it risks its own sudden descent into brutality, transgressing the constitutional commitment to decency and restraint. You will learn over the years that Justice Kennedy likes words like dignity and decency, into which emotional, personal, subjective sentiments may be poured. He concluded that there was a national consensus against the death penalty for child rapists because only five states imposed that penalty for that crime. The court erroneously concluded, as I mentioned before, that the federal government also did not have such a penalty. Four times the Kennedy opinion in the Kennedy case stated that the national consensus concerning national standards of decency precluded expanding the death penalty to instances where the victim's life is not taken, because the rape of a child cannot be compared in severity and irrevocability to murder. Of course, this case was not about expanding the death penalty, so that particular rhetorical flourish in the opinion that we saw four times was a ruse, suggesting that the court was being asked to take the death penalty further than ever before. That was plainly not the case. At the core of the court's opinion, the court forthrightly acknowledged that it is our own, I'm using the words of the opinion, our own judgment, our own understanding of the Constitution, and our own independent judgment that carries the day. Much like Justice Stevens' statement in the lethal injection case, that he had to be guided by his own experience in rejecting the death penalty as unconstitutional, or Justice Stewart's famous statement in another context, I know it when I see it. This is what it is all about in a world of judicial supremacy. Judges will reach down into their hearts and their experience and decide for us what is cruel, what is unusual, what is reasonable, what is due, what is just, or what is equal. And that is why, of course, a President Obama will be looking to appoint justices with the right heart, soul, and life experiences. Justice Kennedy offered additional factors to support the court's decision. That child rape occurs more often than first-degree murder, therefore, too many people would be executed. Youthful victims would have to decide whether to testify against the rapist, which, quote, forces a moral choice on the child who is not of a mature age to make that choice. Of course, whenever a crime like this is committed, the child's testimony is probably necessary. That the death penalty adds to the risk of non-reporting, which diminishes the objective of deterrence, and that the death penalty removes an incentive not to kill the victim. Justice Alito's dissent was compellingly analytical and powerfully persuasive. He is clearly, at the end of his second and a half term, starting to get his confidence and his rhythm. His opinions are excellent. In summary, he said that the majority had prohibited the imposition of the death penalty for raping a child, quote, no matter how young the child, no matter how many times the child is raped, no matter how much children the perpetrator rapes, how many children the perpetrator rapes, no matter how sadistic the crime, no matter how much physical or psychological trauma is inflicted, and no matter how heinous the perpetrator's prior criminal record may be. Justice Alito demonstrated that the national consensus, the so-called national consensus against the death penalty for rapists of children, was utterly bogus. Earlier decisions by the court had discouraged states from adopting laws making rape of a child a capital offense, as they might have done. He pointed out that Justice Kennedy's other factors, the four that I mentioned a moment ago, were policy judgments that were either not true, not comprehensible, or immaterial to the question whether the death penalty in these cases was cruel and unusual. Finally, he powerfully refuted the court's conclusion that murder is, quote, unique in its moral depravity and in the severity of the injury that it inflicts on the victim and the public. The repeated rape and torture of young children, he explained, certainly manifest greater depravity than some murders. Indeed, these crimes are often, in the eyes of most Americans, the epitome of moral depravity. I have no doubt that the vast majority of this audience and a comparable segment of the American public would agree with what he said. The court's national consensus consists of five justices. The Second Amendment provides that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. For years, gun control advocates and liberals everywhere have claimed that the Second Amendment, like the Third Amendment, which protects us from being forced to quarter troops in our homes, is an antiquated curiosity that means nothing today except to protect the rights of a state militia to have guns. In District of Columbia versus Heller, in a 5-4 opinion authored by Justice Scalia, the court held that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in a militia and to use that weapon for traditional lawful purposes such as self-defense within the home. The District of Columbia's total ban on handgun possession in the home is therefore an unconstitutional infringement of a right to possess and use a class of arms that Americans overwhelmingly choose for lawful self-defense. Justice Scalia's masterful and comprehensive opinion builds upon an equally thorough and powerfully persuasive D.C. Circuit opinion authored by Judge Lawrence Silverman. In each of these opinions is among the finest each jurist has produced in their respective distinguished careers on the bench. Each opinion systematically considered and systematically and compellingly overpowered every argument that has been put forth over the years to relegate the Second Amendment to emptiness. Indeed, as the Scalia opinion emphasizes, the Second Amendment, like the First and Fourth Amendments, codifies an existing right that is a right that shall not be infringed, not simply a right granted by the Constitution, but one of those fundamental rights that exists irrespective of the Constitution, and which is protected by the Second Amendment from infringement under the Constitution. Justice Scalia's opinion thoroughly examines practices at the time of the Second Amendment was adopted, its historical antecedents, its purpose, comparable provisions in state constitutions, its understanding by contemporary constitutional scholars, and its interpretation in early court decisions, as well as later, more recent Supreme Court decisions. None of this history and analysis remotely supports the dissenter's position that the amendment was intended to protect only weapons used for military service. The Scalia opinion meticulously examines and rebuts the arguments set forth in the dissents by Justice Stevens and Justice Breyer. Arguments, particularly those advanced by Justice Stevens, are dismissed as, quote, dead wrong or, quote, demonstrably not true. He rejects one of Justice Stevens' arguments as unknown this side of the looking glass, except apparently in some course on linguistics, and worthy of the Mad Hatter, mocking a brief filed. This is a new one. This is a new one, a brief by linguistics, linguists, right? Justice Stevens' dissent, joined by Justices Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, flatly assert that there is no indication that the framers of the amendment intended to enshrine the common law right of self-defense in the Constitution. The Stevens opinion placed heavy reliance on the Court's 1939 decision in U.S. versus Miller, which upheld a federal prohibition on short-barrel shotguns. That precedent, Justice Stevens urged, is dispositive, building, in the way he argued in this case, essentially a stare decisis case. There it is again. He pronounced Justice Scalia's elaborate analysis of the language of the amendment, its constitution, and contemporary understandings. He responded to that by saying, well, that's unpersuasive. But Miller, that Supreme Court case, merely upheld the banning of a particular type of weapon and made no pretension of disposing of the individual versus collective right issues. It was never well settled, as Justice Stevens asserted, nor does the Heller decision work a dramatic upheaval in the law as the Stevens dissent hyperventilates. It is ironic for Justice Stevens to quote Justice Cardozo for the proposition, quote, that the labor of judges would be increased almost to the breaking point if every past decision could be reopened in every case, and one could not lay one's course of bricks on the secure foundation of the courses laid by others who had gone before him. This is from the author of probably a greater number of blatant as well as more circuitous reversals of earlier precedents than any justice on the court today. I reserve for last one of the Supreme Court's most difficult decisions to understand and to defend. In Boumediene versus Bush, the court granted the right of the writ of habeas corpus to aliens held outside the United States and classified as hostile combatants by the president, notwithstanding explicit congressional authorization to try them before military tribunals. First, a brief slice of history. The framers of our Constitution gave Congress the power to declare war and the president broad power to conduct war as the commander-in-chief. According to Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist Papers 70, 74, and 78, and these are quotes, energy in the executive is a leading character in the definition of good government. It is essential to the protection of the community against foreign attacks. Military authority is to be concentrated in the president alone. Of all cases or concerns of government, the direction of war, most particularly, demands those qualities which distinguish the exercise of power by a single hand. The executive holds the sword of the community. The judiciary has no influence over the sword. The judiciary was described as the weakest branch of government by the federal government, in part because it possessed neither the power of the purse nor of the sword. In his famous 1952 concurring opinion in the Steele seizure cases, Justice Robert Jackson explained that, quote, when the president acts pursuant to an express or implied authorization of Congress, his authority is at its maximum, for it includes all that he possesses in his own right, plus all that Congress can delegate. And in 1950, in Johnson versus Eisentrager, the Supreme Court, in a Robert Jackson opinion, held beyond any doubt that the Constitution does not ensure habeas corpus for aliens held by the United States in areas over which our government is not sovereign. Indeed, at the end of World War II, the United States held 400,000 prisoners in the United States alone. Not a single one was accorded the right to habeas corpus in a federal court. So, when Congress in 2001 authorized the use of military force against terrorists and our soldiers captured hostile forces, the Commander-in-Chief, relying on his constitutional authorities as Commander-in-Chief and the Eisentrager opinion, took them off the battlefield and housed them far away from armed combat, where written agreements with Cuba explicitly provided that the sovereign power of the United States did not extend. Then, in 2004, in Rasul versus Bush, the court reversed the result in Eisentrager and held that enemy combatants held in Guantanamo did indeed have the right to seek habeas corpus review of their custody under the same statute construed exactly the opposite way in Eisentrager 50 years before. As Justice Scalia explained in his dissent in the Rasul case, the President, relying on the court's precedents, had placed dangerous combatants in a place where they and their captors would be safe and from which escape was all but impossible. Yet the court overturned the statutory interpretation that Congress had left standing for 54 years and opened the door to habeas proceedings in 94 district courts to Guantanamo detainees. These are aliens captured abroad, never brought to the United States. Congress responded to the Rasul decision by enacting the Detainee Treatment Act, which explicitly, it's hard to imagine it could be more clear, explicitly provided that no court, justice, or judge shall have jurisdiction to consider the habeas application of a Guantanamo Bay detainee. No court, no justice, no judge shall have jurisdiction to consider the habeas application of a Guantanamo detainee. Now, you would have thought that that would have brought the matter to an end. But in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld in 2006, the court came to the startling conclusion that the Detainee Treatment Act did not apply to combatants who had already filed and were pursuing habeas claims in federal court, the very persons that the legislature knew about and enacted that legislation to address. Both Rasul and Hamdan, by the way, were written by the same Justice Stevens who wrote so admiringly of the doctrine of stare decisis in this term's Second Amendment case. The Hamdan court explicitly then went on to invite the President to return to Congress to seek the authority for the trial of Guantanamo detainees by military commission. So he did. And Congress duly enacted the Military Commissions Act, providing for military commissions to review detainee claims and limiting the right to habeas corpus to prevent the second-guessing of the decisions of those tribunals. As Justice Scalia states in his Boumediene dissent, it turns out the Hamdan justices, were just kidding when they invited Congress and the President to address and solve the detainee situation. This time, Justice Stevens did not write the opinion himself. He assigned it to Justice Kennedy, who wrote that the Military Commission Act unconstitutionally took away from the Guantanamo detainees the right to seek habeas corpus review of the conditions of their detention. The Kennedy opinion admitted that it found no founding era precedents or legal commentaries that clearly supported the conclusion that alien detainees on foreign soil had a United States constitutional right to access to United States courts. Nor did the court regard the evidence of the scope of the writ at common law dispositive. Standing alone, the absence of support for habeas review in these circumstances, no clear record of such a support at the time of the founding of the Constitution, would seem to have compelled the court to give deference instead to the collective judgments of Congress and the President, especially in light of the President's preeminent constitutional authority in matters of war, military circumstances, and national defense. But these considerations were given virtually no weight by the court, and the court found a new constitutional habeas right for non-citizen combatants on foreign soil clearly not contemplated at any time by the Founding Fathers. Nor was the court fazed. Now the court was not fazed by its acknowledgement that Cuba retains sovereignty over Guantanamo in the words of the opinion, in the legal and technical sense. Let me say that again. It didn't make a difference that Cuba retains sovereignty over Guantanamo in, quote, the legal and technical sense. The court gave short shrift to the government's contention that de jure sovereignty is the touchstone of habeas corpus, as if the formal, documented legal relationship between Cuba and the United States meant nothing, and as if the Supreme Court was not a court of law, which is what de jure means. I looked it up again in Black's Law Dictionary this morning. It was still there. Instead of the legal and technical stuff, the de jure business, the court adopted a functional approach. Have you heard that before? Guided by practical concerns. If this sounds like judicial supremacy to you, you are right. The court shifted the burden to the government to justify its wartime command decisions, and found the president's arguments insufficiently persuasive. It concluded that the government had presented, quote, no credible arguments that the military mission at Guantanamo, quote, would be compromised if habeas courts had jurisdiction over the detainees' capture and detention. In short, the president's judgments about the war that Congress had authorized him to conduct and his detention and trial of combatants, according to explicit congressional authorization, wasn't persuasive enough. The court did not specify what sort of procedures the detainees would be entitled to, asserting candidly that, quote, our opinion does not address the content of law that governs petitioners' detention, close quote. The court left that to a case-by-case process that will undoubtedly take years, countless proceedings, and many more appeals to judicial commanders-in-chief and federal courts everywhere in this country. And, of course, whatever our military commanders do will be susceptible to post hoc judicial decisions that the president and our military have violated laws that the court will decide and pronounce at some time in the unknown future. The court did state, however, that each detainee must be given a meaningful opportunity to demonstrate that he is being held pursuant to, quote, an erroneous application or interpretation of relevant law. In short, it seems that someone captured on a battlefield in Iraq or Afghanistan must be shown by the commander-in-chief to have been captured and to have been held according to some unspecified relevant law, and the detainee must be given the opportunity in a United States court, quote, to rebut the factual basis for the government's assertion that he is an enemy combatant. Bear in mind that captured combatants are seldom detained for the purpose of being charged with some violation of U.S. criminal law. They are not. They are captured because they are trying to kill or maim our troops and detained so that they won't go back to doing so the same thing tomorrow. And these are terrorist guerrillas who seldom carry identification or fight for any specific identifiable regime. They have been trained not only to kill, but to lie. Can you imagine a Marine or a soldier having to prove the factual basis for believing a particular captured fighter was trying to kill him in the mountains of Afghanistan? Consider the care that will be required in capturing explosive-bearing terrorists, the witnesses that will have to be interviewed, the statements taken, the records preserved, and the hearings conducted, not to mention the rights extended to captured combatants. Next, of course, we will see suits for damages against our soldiers for violating the constitutional rights of terrorists routed from caves in Pakistan or spider holes in Iraq. The court specifically suggests the right to confront witnesses, the assistance of counsel, the application of rules of evidence, the right of access to exculpatory evidence, and the right even to challenge the president's right to detain terrorist attackers. Surely Miranda, Brady, Bivens, the Federal Tort Claims Act, and war crimes trials cannot be far behind. Justice Kennedy closed his opinion by pronouncing that the court's decision, quote, does not undermine the executive powers as commander-in-chief. On the contrary, the exercise of those powers is vindicated, not eroded, when confirmed by the judicial branch. What a revealing and remarkable statement that is. The Kennedy opinion is full of discussion about separation of powers, but that concept really means that the president's power as commander-in-chief, executed pursuant to congressional authorization, is subject to the supervision and vindication by the judicial branch, also by non-vindication of the judicial branch. That is not the separation of powers. That is judicial supremacy. We do not have time to give adequate voice to the two superb dissents authored by the Chief Justice and Justice Scalia. Let me quote simply a couple of lines from each opinion. First, from the Chief Justice. Today, the court strikes down as inadequate the most generous set of procedural protections ever afforded aliens detained by this country as enemy combatants. The political branches crafted these procedures amidst an ongoing military conflict after much careful investigation and thorough debate. The court rejects them today out of hand without bothering to say what due process rights the detainees possess, without explaining how the statute fails to vindicate those rights, and before a single petitioner has even attempted to avail himself of the law's operation. And to what effect? The majority merely replaces a review system designed by the people's representatives with a set of shapeless procedures to be defined by a federal court at some future time. Then from Justice Scalia's dissent, the court today decrees that no good reason to decrees that it has no good reason to accept the judgment of the other two branches. None is apparent. The government, it declares, presents no credible arguments that the military mission at Guantanamo would be compromised if habeas corpus courts had jurisdiction to hear the detainees' claims. What competence does the court have to second-guess the judgment of Congress and the President on such a point? None whatever. Henceforth, as today's opinion makes unnervingly clear, how to handle enemy prisoners in this war will ultimately lie with the branch that knows least about the national security concerns that the subject entails. The game of bait and switch that today's opinion plays upon the nation's commander-in-chief will make the war harder on us. It will almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. Well, we have reached the time to conclude. Summing up, as you can see, a full term of the court's work is particularly problematic when the term ends, as it does every year, it seems, with several lengthy, highly controversial opinions on difficult and important subjects. If I were to recommend further reading to you, it would be the majority and dissenting opinions in the Louisiana death penalty case, the Second Amendment case, and the enemy combatant cases. It's a lot of reading, by the way. That would provide you, however, with powerful insights into the jurisprudence of the justices who had the biggest impact this year: Roberts, Stevens, Scalia, Kennedy, and Alito. The court has already accepted an interesting collection of 40 or more cases for argument next term. I will close with just one to watch: Winter versus Natural Resources Defense Council. Now that the courts have taken jurisdiction over the capture and custody of enemy combatants, they will next decide whether whales, lawyers, and judges will decide when and where submarine commanders may use sonar to protect the cities on our nation's coastlines. Thank you.
Ted, as you know, in this chapter we have a tradition of giving our speakers a leather-bound copy of the Federalist Papers, and in your case it really would be bringing coals to Newcastle. So we got you a nice bottle of wine.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.